a good Tuesday morning to you. Welcome into the Nick Craig Show, streaming live this morning on YouTube, Rumble, X, and Facebook. Don't forget that you can take the show with you 24/7 on demand by checking out the Nick Craig Show in your favorite podcast app. You can listen online by visiting the website, nickcraig.com. Our show this morning is brought to you in part, as always, by the good people, Melissa Gott and her team over at the Law Group here in Wilmington. Give them a call, 910-251-6088, or visit their website online at lawgroupnc.com. We've got a lot to get into on this Tuesday morning, but we will start off what is looking to be a horrific situation about to unfold in Jamaica. You are looking at live data from the National Hurricane Center on Hurricane Melissa. As it stands right now, it is the seventh strongest hurricane ever in the Atlantic Basin. This thing is an absolute freaking monster, moving north-northeast at 5 miles an hour, pressure at 901 millibars. That is incredibly low, with its maximum sustained winds at 175 miles per hour. And you can see from the infrared satellite loop here, the monster of a storm that this is, almost a perfect circle eyewall that spans about 12 miles wide, that is going to unleash, there's not even a word to describe the level of devastation that Jamaica is going to see over the day today. With an eyewall like this, with a storm with these pressures, 901 millibars, these very strong high-end Category 5 winds, it is going to be utter devastation for portions of central and western Jamaica as the information continues to come in on this. Of course, Jamaica taking the first blow now, but if you just look up the map a little bit, you get into portions of Cuba as well that will be seeing likely a very strong hurricane as well, likely a Category 4 storm. Here is the latest chart from the National Hurricane Center showing what is going on with this storm right now. You can see that these hurricane warnings are in effect for all of Jamaica, all of the every corner of Jamaica, a vast majority of eastern Cuba, and then into some of the Lesser Antilles as well, into the Bahamas as well, with some of these hurricane warnings as this storm is going to go through Jamaica today, Cuba into the day tomorrow, through parts of the Bahamas. And then fortunately, the track does look to take it out to sea, at least from a U.S. coastal standpoint. But look at right here, you've got Bermuda that could likely be dealing with some remnants, even still a hurricane, as we head into Friday. So looking at a wide swath of devastation from this storm. Again, looking at this, I mean, you hate to say this, but from a purely meteorological standpoint, an absolutely textbook hurricane. I mean, you don't get any more textbook in terms of what the satellite looks like for this storm right now. Some live cameras coming in from Sea Jamaica, and while most of the island is still with power, there is a very strong likelihood that over the next couple of hours, the storm probably making landfall here over the next 3 or 4 hours, that the power will be disturbed to almost the entirety of the island. Fortunately, the track shifting over the last couple of days leaves Kingston, which is, of course, the largest city on Jamaica, is not making a direct impact on Kingston. However, regardless of whether it's a direct impact or not, the effects are going to be felt wide and far all across Jamaica. I included in my morning line email this morning, I say a prayer for the people of Jamaica, as they have not dealt with a major landfalling hurricane since the late 1980s. Which, by I'll note, in itself is pretty remarkable when you look at where Jamaica is on a map. This is going to be a very devastating storm, and we will watch that unfold throughout the day today. A sad situation unfolding for Jamaica, as you can see some of those live cameras there from See Jamaica. They've got a great YouTube channel with dozens of cameras that have been or that are always live, but obviously are seeing some increased viewership over the last couple of days as this storm is making its way in. So that is what we are tracking. Unfortunate situation for Jamaica. We'll keep an eye on it throughout the day. And just to really hone in on what we're expecting, you don't typically see this kind of verbiage from the National Hurricane Center. This is as of their 5 a.m. Eastern advisory. Tropical storm conditions are occurring in Jamaica, and catastrophic hurricane force winds are expected to begin this morning within the eye wall. Total structural failure is likely. I mean, it does not get any worse than that in terms of messaging from the National Hurricane Center. Total structural failure is likely, especially in higher elevation areas where wind speeds atop and the windward side of the hills and mountains could be up to 30% stronger. So again, 30% stronger. I mean, you've already got 175 mile an hour winds in the storm right now. This is a devastating situation for Jamaica. Really unfortunate to see. But I'll note, remarkable that the island has not had a major landfalling hurricane since, not I think it was 1988. So that in itself is good, but this is a really, really bad situation. And you know, one of the things I've been reading and following over the last couple of hours is, you know, with the devastation that's going to take place and the impact on infrastructure, getting aid and supplies into Jamaica in the immediate aftermath of this storm is going to be very tough. Both of the major Jamaican airports, one in Kingston and Montego Bay, both of those already shut down. So it's going to be interesting to see what the response is after the fact. Obviously, the United States, and you would expect other nations, will do everything in their power to try and get aid in. It's just from a purely infrastructure standpoint, it's not immediately clear what that is going to look like or how that is going to happen. So say a prayer for the people of Jamaica this morning. This is a disastrous situation that is unfolding right now and will continue to unfold throughout the day. All right, transitioning over to some political happenings this morning across the United States. Obviously, the government shutdown does continue. Pressure continues to ratchet up on the Democrats for their failure to reopen the government and continue to push for some ridiculous, nonsensical policies and programs. President Donald Trump is in Asia this morning. He is currently with the Prime Minister of Japan. He was speaking just a little bit ago and announced some pretty big infrastructure or a pretty big announcement in terms of investment with Japan, $490 billion, which will include nuclear reactors, large-scale power equipment, construction and engineering services. So a $490 billion investment deal just coined and solidified with Japan. So that is great news, and we are seeing that unfold this morning, as well as the president does conduct another international trip. We'll follow those details throughout the day. But turning back stateside, you have seen the drama, the outrage over the last like week and a half or so over what's going on the east wing of the White House, and this discussion over Trump demolishing the White House, which is what is being said by some on the left, demolishing the White House to build a ballroom. And so this has been something that is very interesting to follow. And I've got a pretty jaw-dropping opinion piece over at the Washington Post. This was written by their editorial board. It's an opinion piece. And the headline is this, and we'll get into the details in a minute. Opinion, editorial board, in defense of the White House ballroom. So you've got the Washington Post, Democracy Dies in Darkness, right? That this individual, that this media outlet, this entity that will never and will do anything in their power to never give Republicans, conservatives, Trump, anybody associated with him credit for anything that they do, runs this editorial board piece over the weekend in defense of the White House ballroom. I want to read through that here in a little bit, because it is an interesting piece and it really solidifies the ridiculous nature in which in the ridiculous way in which this conversation has unfolded. I'm not going to sit here and give you a history lesson this morning on all of the renovations that have taken place at the White House. I don't think that that is relevant. I don't really think it proves any point. Yes, of course, there are consistently renovations, changes, upgrades, additions to the White House. I mean, it has happened all throughout history. I mean, Christ, the current White House press briefing room used to be a freaking swimming pool. I mean, literally, it was a swimming pool. That's why it's such a weird, narrow room. When you watch the White House press secretary and Caroline Leavitt, you might wonder, like, why is the room set up like that? Well, it was originally where a swimming pool was. So it's a very narrow room, as you would expect for a pool, which, of course, tends to be rectangular in nature. So there's always been additions. There's always been modifications. There's always been changes to the White House. And what I find interesting about this in particular is has been the reaction from those on the political left. They are once again putting themselves in a situation where they are completely out of touch, I think, not necessarily with the American people, but completely out of touch with what is going on. Completely out of touch with like general public sentiment and what is going on. I mean, you would, if you have followed the coverage of this over the last couple of days now, you would be of the mindset that the President of the United States and Donald Trump has taken a bulldozer to the entire White House. I mean, that is what you would be led to. That's what you're being led to believe by those on the left. That the symbol of American democracy, the house on Pennsylvania Avenue, has been demolished by this administration and by Donald Trump. And it could not be, of course, as typical, any further from the truth. So what you've got going on is the construction, hopefully, of a ballroom for the White House, which I will be the first to admit, and I have no problem commenting and highlighting. I'm not going to sit here and pretend to you, I never have, that I know everything about what's going on. I was, and again, this is the ignorance of me, I was kind of already under the impression that the White House had a large ballroom to suffice large events that would take place at the White House in Washington, D.C., and to my shock and surprise, that is actually not the case. Now, there are some cocktail rooms and there are some dining rooms within the White House, but they're not very large. I mean, the largest ballroom, if you want to call it that, and it would not be described as a ballroom, but the largest room for events is the East Room, which only seats about 200 people. And you might say, Nick, 200 people, that's a lot. Well, yes and no. I mean, when you've got major like state dinners and other major functions taking place at the White House, where you've got especially something with a state visit from a foreign dignitary, those foreign dignitaries travel with hundreds of people. Then, of course, on the White House side, you've got hundreds of people associated with the administration. A 200-person room is not sufficient for an event like that. And again, I'll have no problem showing my ignorance. I assume they had a larger space. As you have seen over the years, there's a lot of functions that take place in and around an administration. A lot of events, a lot of galas, a lot of balls, things of that nature. I always just assumed that they had a large venue to do that. In fact, they do not. So let's get over to this piece over at the Washington Post. The headline again, in defense of the White House ballroom. It reads and says in part, the teardown of the White House's East Wing this week, this was published on Sunday, is a Rorschach test. Many see the rubble as a metaphor for President Donald Trump's reckless disregard of norms and the rule of law, a reflection of his willingness to bulldoze history and a temple to a second Gilded Age, paid for by corporate donors. Others see what they love about Trump: a lifelong builder boldly pursuing a grand vision, a change agent unafraid to decisively take on the status quo, and a developer slashing through red tape that would stymie any normal politician. And I think it's a pretty good open and pretty good setup here from the Washington Post. And this is why from the left, you're seeing the reaction that you are. If you have listened to and understand the rhetoric that exists on the left side of the political aisle, then this is their worst possible nightmare, right? You consistently hear and consistently are told that Donald Trump, he himself, he is destroying the fabric of the United States. He is destroying our so-called democracy. I'll always remind you that we are not a democracy. We are a democratic republic. But he is destroying our democracy. Everything that has been America is just going to be leveled by this administration. So when video is comes out last week showing some demolition taking place in the East Wing of the White House, it is everything that Democrats believe and feel about Trump. Like, not only is he systematically destroying our democracy because he's an authoritarian, right? But now he's literally destroying the White House. Now he's literally taking a bulldozer and a wrecking ball to the White House, the symbol, one of the many symbols that is the American experiment. So for them, the immediate outrage, the immediate knee-jerk reaction to, oh my God, this is the worst thing that's ever happened. It's not like every single freaking president hasn't made some modification or change to the White House. I'll be the first to admit some are larger renovations and modifications. Some are smaller. There are changes all the time. Some are major, some are not. Some install swimming pools and basketball courts. Some redo wiring. I mean, this stuff has consistently happened. So the videos and the pictures of this last week, which of course became a media frenzy point, back up their completely unsubstantiated feelings that Donald Trump is destroying the fabric of democracy. That the president of the United States, evil, awful, terrible Donald Trump, is literally bulldozing the White House. So this, it makes perfect sense as to why the reaction was what it was, to at least from my vantage point. Right? If you are of the mindset that this guy is destroying everything that is sane and normal about the United States, and then you're watching CNN and when watching a bulldozer literally tear apart a wall on the East Wing of the White House, you're like, oh my God, it's true. Like, like everything that I already knew was the case is now I'm physically watching it unfold in front of my very eyes. So it gave them the kind of boost that they needed to back up all of their ridiculously stupid and nonsensical claims. So back to the Washington Post article. In classic Trump fashion, the president is pursuing a reasonable idea in the most jarring manner possible. Privately, many alumni of the Biden and Obama White Houses acknowledge the long overdue need for an event space like what Trump is creating. It is absurd that tents are needed to be erected on the south lawn of the White House for state dinners and VIPs are forced to use porta potties. And so this is a very real and true thing. This is a picture from, I believe this is from 2012 at the White House of a state dinner. And again, I'm going to show my ignorance here. I just didn't think that this stuff was the case. I mean, this is literally a tent on the south lawn of the White House. You can see the Washington Monument right behind this photo. This is where major state dinners were happening. When you needed an event space at the White House or on White House grounds where you needed to seat more than 200 people, this was the solution. Literally rolling out a white tent that you would see at a wedding venue as the event space. Now, it's obviously a little bit more structurally sound. It's a little bit more structured than just your traditional white pop-up tent. But at the end of the day, ladies and gentlemen, this is a white tent. I mean, you can see all of the vinyl toppings and siding hanging because it's a tent. It's got It's a tent. At the end of the day, it is a white canvas tent. And so that's what it looked like. And I would argue this is completely absurd. That the White House, that I would argue across the globe, one of the most powerful physical structures anywhere in the world, if you go to pretty much any corner of the earth and ask individuals if they know what the White House is, and ask them, point out the White House on this map, point out the White House, a picture of the White House, pretty much everybody is going to know. And the fact that this was the solution for large events is completely absurd. And so President Donald Trump, to the chagrin of many on the left, what many on the right love about him, is a true pragmatist when it comes to solving problems. We can't host events with larger than 200 people without setting up some stupid white tent on the front of the south lawn of the White House, with people having to use porta potties to go to the bathroom. That's not a good solution. So the president did, well, pretty much exactly what you would expect him to do. How do we find a solution to this problem? What can we do within the White House? What structural changes need to be made so that this picture that you're seeing is not the norm? And I mean, I saw this, some of these pictures as well. This is from 2009, and this is a state visit with the Prime Minister of India back in 2009 during the Obama administration. And this is, in fact, taking place on a very similar white tent on the grounds of the White House. I mean, and it's nuts that this was the solution. Donald Trump says, nope, we're finding something else. The state dining room seats 140 people within the White House, and the East Room seats about 200. The President Trump says, however, that this ballroom at the center of his 90,000 square foot addition will accommodate 999 guests, so just shy of 1,000 people. The next Democratic president will be happy to have this. This is the Washington Post writing this. Again, this ran Sunday over at the Washington Post. Again, the headline here, in defense of the White House ballroom, an opinion from their editorial board. Preservationists express horror that Trump did not submit his plans to their scrutiny. But the truth is that this project would have not gotten done, certainly not during his term, if the president had gone through the traditional review process. The blueprints would have been faced by 1,000 paper cuts, or death by 1,000 cuts. Fortunately for Trump, the White House is exempt from some of the required regulations that other federal buildings must comply with, because it has become far too difficult to build anything in America. Predominant Democrats have become vocal this year in calling out their party's lawyerly obsession with the process, which combined with a not in my backyard or NIMBY mentality has prevented a place such as California from building high-speed rail projects that its voters approved in a referendum in 2008. And of course, this article doesn't mention what's going on right now in California. You had those horrific wildfires take place earlier this year. And it is going to take a decade for some of these homes to be rebuilt, not because the insurance money's not there, not because the homeowners are not ready to rebuild, but because of all of the bureaucratic red tape and government regulation that exists in California. And because of that regulation, because of the bureaucracy, individuals are going to wait, in some cases, a decade, if not more, before they can get their house rebuilt. So bravo to the Democrats in California. The Washington Post article goes on to say, many homeowners have become red-pilled by their struggles to navigate the slow-as-molasses maze of government bureaucracy when they're trying to make even modest renovations, such as adding a deck. D.C. alone has 70 historic districts and other random entities that can throw sand into the gears. Though the fundraising of the ballroom creates a problematic conflict of interest, two examples validate Trump's aggressive approach. After a fence jumper got inside the White House in 2014, it was obvious that better perimeter fencing needed to be installed. but doing so involved 5 public meetings with the National Capital Planning Commission over 2 years, as members took pains to ensure the fencing complied with environmental rules. Construction didn't begin until July 2019. So it's always a risk. One of the things I learned in radio is you never count or do math on air, but we're going to try and do this together. So 2014, this happened. So we're going to count together. Use my fingers here. 2015, 2016, 2017, 2018, and 2019. I have 5 fingers up. So 5 years between when somebody jumped the fence at the White House in 2014 and they said, you know, these fences, they probably need to be bolstered a little bit. They probably need to be fortified a little bit. It took them 5 freaking years to get new fencing installed. And why was that the case? Well, because you had to go in front of the National Capital Planning Commission and you had to listen to a bunch of Democrats complain about the environment, talk about how this is not good for the environment, how this is not environmentally sound. There's a snail that might live in this area and this snail is a species that could be gone tomorrow and we need to protect this snail at all costs. And you know, just all the typical environmental bullshit that you see from those on the left. And just going on a little bit of a tangent here, one of the individuals within this administration that I do not believe is getting enough credit is Lee Zeldin. He was a former member of Congress, ran and had a really good election in New York State running against Kathy Hochul as governor. He obviously was not successful, but boy, did he give the Democrats one hell of a run for their money in New York. He is doing an absolutely masterful job at EPA. When you look at, not even the deep state, but when you look at what is wrong with government, when you look at some of the frustrations that exist in either local government, federal government, or state government, these environmental agencies are oftentimes the worst offenders. They will do anything in their power to slow something down. And through soil sample studies and underwater groundwater studies, and again, looking at a slug or a butterfly or an ant or some bird that lives nearby, they can take what is a relatively simple thing like, oh, I don't know, bolstering the perimeter fences at the White House. They will take something that is a relatively simple process and turn it into a 5-year ordeal. And that's exactly what happened with the fence at the White House. This is what happens with local zoning and planning boards and commissions. Oh, you want to install a new extension on your house? You want, as the Washington Post article notes, you want to install some sort of outdoor deck? Well, enjoy sitting through dozens of historic commission meetings to make that happen. It's government out of control. And it's a major, major problem. And hopping off my tangent here, Lee Zeldin is doing a great job at breaking this bureaucracy at EPA, which has a complete and total stranglehold over so many facets of our country. I mean, pretty much any decision that is made nationally, you've got the EPA sticking their nose in there to worry about, what is the environmental impact of this? Is this going to affect climate change? Is this going to affect this? Is this going to affect that? Just consistently bogging down the process for not any meaningful reason, right? We're not talking about, just dumping gasoline or petroleum products all over the ground. We're talking about building a new fence. And even that process takes the better part of, half a dozen years to take place, all because we've got to bog down, we've got to slow down this process in any way, shape, or form so that it doesn't get done. And of course, we can continue to justify our existence, which is really what most of this is all about. The reason that these entities and agencies are as rabid as they are is because they have to justify their existence. They have to justify why they still exist at all. So they take their sweet ass time with everything, and the end result is, whether it's the White House or you as a random property owner anywhere across the country, something that you want to do takes forever. All in the name of good governance. All in the name of protecting the environment, so on and so forth. The list goes on and on. We'll get back to this Washington Post piece, very interesting opinion piece by their editorial board over the weekend on some of the modifications at the White House, the president trying to build a 90,000 square foot ballroom so that during state visits, they don't have to keep putting up tents on the South Lawn and have foreign dignitaries using porta potties as a solution. Not necessarily a great look for the United States. We'll get into some more of those details coming up. I do want to remind you that early voting does continue across southeastern North Carolina. We'll get a quick word from Wilmington City Councilman Luke Waddell, and we'll continue on this Tuesday morning show. Don't forget that the Nick Craig Show streams live weekday morning, 7 a.m., YouTube, Rumble, X, Facebook, and available 24/7 wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Luke Waddell, and I'm running for re-election to Wilmington City Council. 4 years ago, I promised strong, principled leadership. Leadership focused on public safety, infrastructure, and fiscal responsibility. I have worked every day to deliver on that promise, voting against unnecessary tax increases and wasteful spending while strongly supporting our police and fire departments. I'm ready to continue working for you. Please go to the polls and vote Luke Waddell for Wilmington City Council. Thank you.
Paid for by committee to elect Luke Waddell.
And a good Tuesday morning to you. Welcome back to the Nick Craig Show live this morning. YouTube, Rumble, X, Facebook, available 24/7 wherever you get your podcasts. Continuing our coverage this morning of the insane idea that the White House should have a ballroom that can seat more than 200 people. And an interesting piece over at the Washington Post this weekend. The headline reads, "In defense of the White House ballroom," written by their editorial board, as you are well aware, as longtime media observers, the Washington Post is anything but friendly to this administration. The Washington Post is anything but friendly to Republicans and practically anything that they do. But in this case, they are calling out Democrats, calling out the left on just their insane outrage over something that is incredibly common sense. So continuing with the piece right now, and they highlight another example of some of the insanity that goes on within the government. It says, "Consider the modest Dwight D. Eisenhower Memorial near the National Air and Space Museum. Congress authorized its creation in 1999. So that would have been 26 years ago. Architect Frank Gehry was selected in 2009. The National Committee Parks Commission rejected the initial design proposal in 2014 before approving a revised plan in 2015. The Commission of the Fine Arts gave it its approval in 2017, and the memorial wasn't opened until late 2020. By contrast, Eisenhower planned and executed D-Day in about 6 months. If that's not the most shocking and jarring example of what is wrong with government, it took them 21 freaking years to build the Dwight D. Eisenhower Memorial. 20 years. The only reason that that happens is because government bureaucrats have to, and I mean absolutely have to, justify their existence. They have to justify, why does the Commission for Fine Arts, they have to justify their existence. So they slow walk these proposals, they slow walk these things ad nauseum to the point where it takes 21 freaking years to build a memorial. And I just love that the Washington Post says, you know, D-Day was executed and planned in about 6 months. One of the most successful military operations in world history took place in the span of 6 months, and it took 21 years to build a freaking building. Bravo, everybody involved. President Trump has said that the project will cost, this is the new ballroom, about $300 million, but he has already raised $350 million from private donors. The White House released a list of 37 donors late last week, including Apple, Amazon, Comcast, Lockheed Martin. Then the Washington Post points out that Amazon, its founder Jeff Bezos, does own the Washington Post. It goes on to read that Trump joined a long list of presidents who have left their imprint on the White House. Theodore Roosevelt replaced greenhouses to construct the West Wing. William Howard Taft constructed the first Oval Office in 1909. Richard Nixon converted a swimming pool into a press briefing room in the 1970s, and the modern East Wing wasn't even built until World War II to cover an underground bunker. Harry S. Truman gutted the White House's interior and added a balcony that bears his name. Purists decried it. Now it's a hallmark. The Washington Post ends their argument or ends their opinion piece by saying, quote, "The White House cannot simply be a museum to the past. Like America, it must evolve with the times to maintain its greatness. Strong leaders reject calcification. In that way, Trump's undertaking is a shot across the bow at NIMBYs everywhere." So a very interesting piece. I did note that there was about 6,000 comments on this post, on this article over at the Washington Post. And as you can imagine, a lot of the comments, not very pleasant comments, lambasting the Washington Post, saying, oh, because Jeff Bezos donated to this, this is why this article was written. And could there be some truth to that? Maybe, possibly. I don't know. I'm not going to sit here and pretend to understand the inner workings of the Washington Post. I don't really think Jeff Bezos cares that much about a ballroom being built, if I'm going to be perfectly honest with you. And I would imagine that he would probably not expend his capital with the individuals over at the Washington Post. Again, he owns it. But I don't think he's going to demand that the editorial board write an article in favor of a ballroom. I don't know Bezos at all either. Doesn't seem like something that he cares all that much about. I can't imagine that like he's sitting in his palatial estates being like frantically worrying about this ballroom being built. He wants his name on it. It's good PR for him. It's good PR for Amazon. It's good PR for the Washington Post for him to donate, for in terms of his net worth, a relatively small sum of money to make this possible. So, maybe that's the case, but this is really just more of an issue of Democrats being just so deranged with their opinions and thoughts on President Trump that they have completely lost control of any sort of normalcy. Byron Donalds was on Fox Business yesterday discussing this and talking about this ballroom. And again, you just have to kind of point out the insanity that exists with this situation. This was a Fox Business yesterday. Take a listen.
The ballroom now can only hold less than 100 people when 10 times that is expected to come over to the White House to celebrate next year.
First of all, the outrage from the left is just that. It's just outrage. They're just mad. They lost last year. They have no footing. They have no leadership. They have no real ideas. So what is it? Just be mad at anything that Donald Trump does. Adding a ballroom to the White House complex is a great idea. It's something that should have happened, quite frankly, long ago, especially considering, and like it was said in your lead-in, you have so many different events that come to the White House. I've been there several times. The last time I was there at a big celebration, it was the Florida Gators celebrating their national championship win in basketball. And in the East Room, it was jam-packed. People are having to like push each other out of the way, try to get some water or get to the bathroom. I mean, they weren't pushing. They were orderly, but I'm making my point. It's very stuffy, very crowded. People are spilling into the hallways. A great, big, beautiful ballroom is what is needed at the White House grounds. And that's for every president into the future, Democrat or Republican. It'll be in the best interest of America.
Yeah, but now
Democrats, stop whining.
We've got Democrat Eric Swalwell demanding all 2028 Democrat potential presidential candidates make a pledge to destroy the new ballroom. The Washington Post put out a report rebutting that, saying President Trump, what he's doing is reasonable, that many alumni of the Biden and Obama White Houses acknowledge this is long overdue, that it's absurd to have state dignitaries sitting outside eating under tents on the South Lawn for state dinners, and then VIPs are forced to use the porta potties. So the Democrats' outrage machine is cranking up over what? I mean, he's got $350 million in private donations, he says, coming in, and he's going to chip in, too.
I told you, their outrage machine is just upset because he's doing something, unlike Joe Biden, who did absolutely nothing. And so they're going to be upset because they have no policies, they have no ideas, and they're trying to figure out how they're going to mount an actual campaign for the midterm elections. But America, they have no policy and they have no ideas. We saw their policy in full action over the last 4 years, and it was absolutely god-awful. So if Eric Swalwell's new litmus test is that people will say to destroy a ballroom that would help a future Democratic president or a future Republican president, that's just stupid. Yeah. But once again, what to expect from my Democratic colleagues is not a lot of common sense.
Again, it's for America.
So, I mean, there you go. There you have it. And I think Byron Donalds points to the larger discussion that we've had on this show for months now, which is the Democrat Party still, which I will admit is shocking to me. We are live this morning. It is October 28th, 2025. We are about 12 months away, a couple days to that, but about 12 months away from the midterm elections. And instead of focusing on anything of substance, instead of focusing on anything that is actually going to affect any American, let's be perfectly clear and honest about this. Whether there is a ballroom built or not, no, 99.99999% of individuals in the United States will never go to this ballroom. They will never see this ballroom. This is something that is going to be for large events like the 250th anniversary that's coming up next year, which will have a relatively small crowd, about 1,000 people or so. When you look at the grand scheme of the U.S. population, that is a minuscule amount of people that will be there. So with all of that being known, with all of that being said, this is what the Democrats are honing in on. They've got the government shut down. They've had it shut down for 28 freaking days now. And their big winning issue, their big topic that is going to bring them to electoral success in 12 months is bitching and moaning over a $350 million ballroom that, by the way, the taxpayers aren't paying for. That, oh, by the way, you and I are not going to cover with our paychecks that come in every couple of weeks. Oh, the shock and outrage. It's just ridiculous. And it really shows that the Democrats have nothing to go for them. And I'll just parlay this into this one final point, and then we'll move on from it. But this was a post yesterday from Anderson Clayton, who is the head of the North Carolina Democrat Party. They released this press release yesterday and said this. The headline is, North Carolina Democrat Party responds to D.C. Republicans using SNAP benefits as a political pawn. Nearly a month ago, Republicans shut down the government to avoid fixing the healthcare disaster they created. Now they're threatening to stop food assistance programs during the shutdown, keeping nearly 40 million Americans from having secure access to meals. In North Carolina, this means approximately 600,000 children and a total of 1.4 million people across our state will have difficulty putting meals on their table every night, let alone for Thanksgiving. Our country cannot continue along this path. It's never been more clear that D.C. Republicans have lost their sense of priorities. Last week, Trump gave Argentina $40 billion, and this week they're claiming they can't afford to make sure that families can eat. Lifelines that are literally keeping families in North Carolina fed are not pawns that Trump can use to force his agenda down our throats. It's time for them to responsibly open the government, ensure SNAP benefits go out on time, and extend the Affordable Care Act subsidies so that nearly a million working people in North Carolina don't see their insurance premiums double in the next week. So this is the framing from the Democrat Party. Meanwhile, it is their ACA, aka Obamacare program, that was a disaster when it was passed, is now rearing its ugly head once again. It is Democrats that for now a dozen times have failed to vote with their Republican colleagues to reopen the government. And so you've got this framing from the North Carolina Democrat Party. And again, I bring this up as to the fact that they have no messaging. And the response from Anderson Clayton, who is the chairwoman of the state's Democrat Party, is F-U-C-K the GOP. That is what she posted on X. This was last night around just before 5 o'clock. F the GOP. That's your messaging? That's what's going to win you a Senate race here in North Carolina next year, Anderson? If I was a Democrat right now, one that didn't have my head so far up my ass that I couldn't see what was going on, I would be terrified for what is coming in November of next year. I would be mortified for what is likely to come because it doesn't look great. It does not look like, and we're far out. I'm not making a final prediction. I'm not planting the flag in the ground. We are not having the parade, no award ceremony yet. There's a lot of time before the midterms. A lot can change. There is still a possibility that Democrats have a good showing. Not discounting anything. 12 months, a lot of time in politics. But this is the messaging. This is the best that they've got. Expletives at the GOP. That's, you think that resonates with the American people? If Democrats cared so much about SNAP, aka food stamps, then they should just vote to reopen the freaking government. There's nothing for the Republicans to cave on, and they're not going to. I mean, it was made abundantly clear last week, and we played some clips on, it was either Thursday or Friday, of the meeting that President Trump had with leaders of the, or with the United States Senate, the Republican Senate at the Oval Office at the White House. Republicans have nothing to give in on. There's nothing for Republicans to compromise on. This is a clean CR to reopen the government. Democrats don't want to do it. Democrats want to pander to the American voting population over how great Obamacare is, even though all the subsidies are running out and everybody's health care is going to double or triple. They want to talk about SNAP benefits, then just vote to reopen the government temporarily. But they don't want to do that. So now it's blame the GOP. This messaging is not working. They've been trying it for 28 days now to pin this shutdown on the Republicans, and it has been in a complete abysmal failure on behalf of the Democrats. They have been woefully and completely unsuccessful in trying to pin this on the GOP. Why? Because it's truly not their fault. Republicans passed the CR in the House at this point 7 weeks ago. They, since October the 1st, have voted a dozen times in the Senate to reopen the reopen the government, and Democrats will not move on the issue. They want to give $1.5 trillion worth of subsidized health care to illegals. They want to continue to fund the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. They want to restart USAID and give money to programs all across the world to research slugs and research snails and some extinct butterfly program and all the transgender story hour in Zimbabwe or whatever stupid garbage they want. This is what they're doing. These policies do not work for the American people. This messaging is not working for the Democrats. And I am genuinely shocked, and I say this and mean it genuinely. I am genuinely shocked that they have not woken up, smelled the coffee on all of this, and tried to figure out, where do we pivot from here? We have to do something else. None of this is working. Screaming that Donald Trump is a threat to democracy, hosting a No King's Day protest with a bunch of white boomers roaming around U.S. cities talking about the end of democracy is not winning over the hearts and minds of the American people. It's just not. There's no polling. There's no evidence. There's no data to back it up whatsoever. And I have made this point for a while now. If Democrats do not begin to pivot soon, the runway is shrinking every single day. From right now until we head into November of next year, the runway is shrinking as to the amount of time that they're going to have to message the American public on why Democrats should gain control of the House and the Senate. Obviously, the president is not on the ballot. They need to gain control of the House, really the House. The Senate, they don't really have a path, but the House, they do. And so what is that messaging going to be? That Trump is building a ballroom at the White House so foreign dignitaries don't have to use porta potties anymore? I mean, that's your grandiose messaging that's going to convince tens of millions of voters to activate across the country and support you? That's your winning message? Oh, no, you're going to go back to 10 years of Donald Trump is a dictator. Donald Trump is a threat to democracy. Donald Trump is an authoritarian. He's a Nazi. He's a racist. He's a bigot. You're going to pull those out of the tool bag again? I mean, it's insane that this party has nothing, that this party has no messaging. Donald Trump has broken them. He has broken their ability to any sort of critical thought. He has broken their ability to push back in the face of adversity, retool, and figure out how to win. They're just not going to. It just does not seem that way as it stands right now. And in terms of, in respect to that, Donald Trump has broken Democrats harder than any other president that we've ever seen. It's been going on for 8, 9, 10 years at this point, and it's not changing. It's not getting any better for them. It's only getting worse. They seemingly are digging their heels in further and further on these nonsensical, stupid issues, like a freaking ballroom at the White House as the winning message for 2026. I would be so pissed off right now if I was a Democrat trying to gain power in 2026. I'd be livid with what I was seeing from people like Anderson Clayton, who is a complete buffoon, from members of Congress who admit on national television that, yeah, you know, people are going to hurt because of this shutdown, but we're going to keep it shut down anyway because we're going to fight back against Donald Trump. I'd be mortified and so pissed off that Democrats could potentially flush a golden opportunity down the toilet next November. So that is what we are tracking. That is what we are following. The outrage continues. The nonsensical coverage from those on the political left continues. And it is a wild situation to watch unfold and just think that this is the best that they've got. This is what they've, like, this is all they've got. This is all that they can provide and bring forward. It's a sad sign of the times for those on the political left. And it does not appear that it is going to be changing anytime soon. So we'll watch the construction of this ballroom. We'll see what happens. You've got Democrats saying, oh, well, once it's built, we'll tear it down. We'll see if that becomes a major rallying cry for Democrats in the midterms as well. We'll keep you up to date with all of it right here on the Nick Craig Show. I do want to remind you that we will be having our Patreon hangout coming up this week for those individuals that do support the show financially. Originally, I had said Wednesday. That's going to be coming up Thursday night for individuals that support the show. You can head on over to patreon.com/Nick Craig and get tuned into that. We'll be sending out that notification today where you can support the show financially and get access to that bonus content available over at patreon.com/Nick Craig, 7 o'clock Thursday night. We look forward to chatting and hearing from everybody. Lots to talk about nationally and internationally, locally as well. We'll get into all of those details coming up Thursday night, patreon.com/Nick Craig. I do want to thank the law group here in Wilmington, Melissa Gott and her team, for their continued support. You can visit them online by visiting their website, lawgroupnc.com. You can, visit them there. You can also give them a call at 910-251-6088. That's 910-251-6088. Well, that's going to do it for a Tuesday edition of the Nick Craig Show, streaming live, YouTube, Rumble, X, and Facebook. And don't forget that you can take the show with you 24/7 on demand by checking out the Nick Craig Show in your favorite podcast app. That's going to do it. We're back with you tomorrow morning on the Nick Craig Show.